we were interviewing Soro, and he was the main warrior, and we're coming to the end of the interview, and then suddenly someone came and yelled something in French, which I didn't understand. And then
in Moré,
and Camilla said, I think the mare is giving birth. And I said, where? We have to stop filming. And we all ran onto the field, and there was this mare in the blazing kind of 40-degree heat giving birth.
And yeah, just to kind of paint this landscape a bit more, it was a riverbed, a kind of a dam that was covered in plastic, like the most amount of plastic bags you can see, a really kind of barren landscape with these kind of stallions prancing around. They were very kind of energized by the mare and her giving birth. So it was just this kind of chaotic scene, and then this foal like being born and opening its eyes to this world that it was going to inhabit, which was full of rubbish, was really remarkable. It was incredible.
And Soro was the person that looked after that mare. And so in the end, once she had given birth to the foal, he was the one that could go up close to her, and she kind of stood up and was comfortable with him because she knew him. And in the end, it was Soro that came and collected the foal in a blanket and carried him off the field.
In his prayer mat.
Yeah, in his prayer mat.
In his prayer mat.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. do you guys remember he just, like, turned around at one point and, like fist-pumped the air and shouted something? What did he shout?
Like, the foal is born in Moré? Like, something about a new horse is here or something?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Camilla Audia. I'm a researcher at King's College London. My main interests in research are climate change adaptation and resilience to climate extremes, and specifically interested in climate services and climate information and weather forecasts.
Hi, my name's Frances Crowley. I'm a researcher at King's as well. My interests are in resilience building and indigenous knowledge and what the latter can bring to the former. And in looking for new and kind of participatory ways of engaging with different audiences.
My name's Maeve Brennan and I'm an artist. I work primarily with moving image. I use a documentary approach to investigate layered and contested sites. So the collaboration between King's and Somerset House provides the opportunity for artists to work closely with researchers and academics and combine approaches. I work closely with experts in my artistic practice anyway, and there was an email sent out which described this project, which was looking at weather forecasting and indigenous forms of knowledge, and this is something that I've looked at in previous projects, documenting oral histories in Palestine to do with Palestinian embroidery or to do with the history of stone, and so I was very excited to meet with Camilla and Frances. So for me, those are the crossovers, kind of ways of documenting a kind of other kinds of knowledge that might not be so well documented already.
For us, looking at obviously what Maeve sent over as examples of her work, it was definitely this idea of showing an image of something, like of a culture, of specific interests that people had that really drew us in. And also this idea that because we were looking at indigenous knowledge that was orally based and hadn't been documented or written out, this was could have been a very good medium to show it to broader audiences and communicate it in a different way than an academic paper.
And we thought that Maeve's work really captured really kind of intimate accounts of people's lives, and that's something that's very hard to portray through a paper or through writing. And we've since found out through the work that we've put together that this is quite effective.
Our project was intending to portray and document personal first-hand testimonies of climate change in a location that was experiencing the extremes of climate change.
What we were picking up in the field weren't necessarily stories of climate change. They were stories of how people work with and adapt to nature and have done throughout centuries. So it became a slightly different angle to our story, but that was part of the beauty of this project. It had that flexibility to respond to what we were finding in Burkina.
Yeah, and I think that's what led to this story of how people predict the weather as a way of understanding how they interact with nature and possibly finding new ways that they could adapt or they have adapted to climate change, which has been sort of a constant in their lives. We were set to go to Burkina at the beginning of June, which is right before the rain season, which is important in terms of people predicting the rain, because we're talking about agricultural cycles that are highly seasonal. We got there without our luggage, needs to be an evening. We got to the capital, so we had to wait a couple of days for our luggage to arrive and also to set up our fieldwork, which was further north, about 150 kilometers north of the capital, Ouagadougou, towards Mali. Which sounds dangerous, but actually wasn't. It's really a calm area. It's mainly rural. We went to different villages and different areas, 7 in total, where we had a combination of interviews that were all filmed by Maeve, but had been set up as part of our research project, which was pre-existing. And we broadened as well the field of the interviews to have different voices and talk to different people. We talk to people who are all from the same ethnic group, but still to men and women, village chiefs, traditional forecasters, mayors, and then just farmers, regular farmers. We spent 3 days in the field and then we got back to the capital. So some of the predominant ways that we found across all the interviews in Burkina were observing bird and plant life. So there's one bird which had a really beautiful name of the rain woman, and when she sings, then they know that they need to start sowing or weeding and preparing the fields, because the rains will come. You know, they said perhaps in the next 2 or 3 days. Insects also kind of figured in their ways of forecasting. So there was a red insect that everyone described as velvety red. We later looked it up on the internet, and it really is this incredibly velvety-looking insect. When they appear again, it's the same message. You have to start preparing. Then there was this whole facet which was around the moon and the stars. And what was really beautiful about their descriptions were, again, very local. So you had people saying when the moon rises over there and pointing to the left-hand side of their compound, their area where they lived, then that meant, I wouldn't want to say actually exactly what it was because I can't remember, but it indicated, again, that either that I think around what the season would be like. Am I right in thinking that? Yeah. So a particular colour in the moon would mean that they would have a good season, for example. Stars as well, like when they appeared in the sky, that also gave a prediction. When the fruits are ripe on specific trees, especially grapes, we were shown the grapes that were just about to get ripe, and people were actually starting to sow when we were there in June. And when the leaves were green as well on some trees, like baobab and mango trees, that meant that they could start preparing the fields because the rains would arrive. It was really interesting because that was also extremely localized, and people had different trees that they could look at depending on where their field was, highlands, lowlands, close to the house or farther from the compound.
One evening we were spending at the stables in Ouagadougou. We were on horses and the electricity cut, and I got off of the horse and I was with Amade, one of the stable workers. And we looked at the ground and there was a toad on the ground. And I said, oh, a toad, so it will rain tomorrow. And it did.
Another thing that needs to be mentioned maybe is around that these are the observation-based findings, but there's also a lot of ceremonial and more spiritual stuff that people talked about a lot. So wise men, yeah, not women, but wise men who spend days inside the house and then come out with predictions around the season, and they're all quite elaborate metaphors that then people can interpret, or village youths can interpret and then tell the farmers what they're about, or as well this idea that the traditions and the genies of the land are quite linked with how the season will be, and that despite the fact that most people will say that they're Muslim, they actually do quite a lot of spiritual stuff in relation to the land and the fact that it's their ancestors' land, and to keep them happy. So like dine in the open to invite all the visible and invisible beings so that the season can be good. We're not scientists, so we weren't there to actually measure if they were useful or not. But first of all, people told them that they were reliable and that they had been relying on them. So I thought that was a very interesting point. And then we had a chance as well to be in a workshop, be involved in a workshop with the Burkina Met Office scientists who were talking about seasonal forecasts, scientifically generated seasonal forecasts. And they asked local farmers what their predictions were based on their indigenous knowledge, and they aligned with the seasonal forecast, much to their surprise, which I thought was an interesting thing. But other than that, we have a feeling that part of the project was to kind of bring the attention of the Met offices to this indigenous knowledge in a way that it needs to be acknowledged and it has value, and in communicating climate information to rural communities, especially in Burkina Faso, it needs to take into account that they do have a very reliable, from their point of view, knowledge and ways of forecasting the weather.
I think one of the key differences that we discovered between kind of traditional indigenous knowledge and Met Office forecasts was the locality and specificity of the forecasts that was necessary for agricultural decision making. Was it needed to be much more local for it to have any use for the rural farmers in Burkina Faso. So when the Met Office forecasts were saying there would be rains in an area, this had little use when they needed to know if the rain would be on their field that day. So it was the farmers were telling us that, you know, it might rain in the next field, in the next village, but it wouldn't rain on mine. So I have to use my indicators to tell me whether to sow or not.
Camilla and my research started from actually a collaboration with the Met Office, so they definitely have an interest, and that's, you know, so there is this acknowledgement amongst some of the climate scientists that this is useful. And there's also, I mean, they're very, very aware of this like big lacuna between like the specificity of information required by farmers and what they're currently able to produce and communicate. And it was interesting to see that farmers did take into account, they did listen to the scientific forecasts on the radio when they could, when they had the opportunity. But there was this, as Maeve mentioned, this kind of awareness that it had to be then put alongside, or it couldn't be relied on to tell them exactly what would happen in their particular area. One thing we did find was that the kind of weather warnings for abnormal weather, extreme weather, were useful to farmers, and those weren't necessarily things it seemed that their local knowledge was able to predict.
All of our interviewees mentioned that they were learning it from their parents and grandparents, and not in a very systematic way, but just by standing next to their mums and dads where they were going to the field, just by basically leaving, they were experiencing it and they were seeing it. In a very organic way, they were interacting with the nature and learning about the indicators themselves, and then about how to predict the forecasts, which I think has an interesting link with what Frances was just saying about the fact that they take into account radio scientific forecasts when they have great warnings, because usually the warnings are linked to very practical actions that need to be taken, and that usually has a straightforward connection in people's minds. So there's going to be an extreme wind, prepare the roofs of your houses, or it's similarly, like you see the green leaves on a tree, prepare your fields for sowing. So I thought that was interesting.
When we got back to the UK, we had the opportunity to look a bit at Indigenous knowledge in the UK as well. And we had a great interview with a man named David King, who's a local expert in Indigenous knowledge. He researches through looking at church records, you know, going back 1,000 or so years, and was this really nice parallel to, you know, something very far away, something very local.
one of the beautiful relationships between David King and the interviews in Burkina Faso was an idea of locality and a kind of real connection to a place, and through kind of constant observation of that place, a kind of knowledge that is sort of tacit. So any shifts in kind of nature or indicators in that area will be immediately obvious to that person because they have such an intimate knowledge of the place.
I was just looking at the December forecast on his website, and I thought it was interesting because of the weird hot autumn, like warm autumn that we've had in London, that he actually did predict this year, then he wasn't able to find some of the indicators to predict the weather in December. So he based a lot of it on like local proverbs and a lot of events that were happening around saints' days in church. And I thought that had a beautiful link with the ceremonies and the metaphors that happened in Burkina.
I really liked the way David King said he came to be interested in weather forecasting, which was through being a policeman and walking the Thames every night and seeing the way that the moon affected the tides. And this kind of, again, this sort of slow, repeated observation that I suppose most of our lives don't really allow for these days. And so there is this kind of real, I mean, this kind of knowledge should be treasured because it's actually telling us so much. And it's very hard to actually have this sustained sort of understanding of a place.
More and more everyone is living an urban life, so what are the possibilities for using a more indigenous approach, which is really necessary, it seems, since things are so unpredictable these days. From previous research undertaken, we'd had the idea that these kind of natural indicators from like bird and insect behaviour were becoming less and less, useful and predictable because insects, etc., were changing their behaviour in relation to climate change. That is not something that's come out strongly from the research that we took in our trip in June. But I think it is something that has been raised and I think it is the case in some other countries or in other pieces of research. I think it's about the process and the approach. And it comes again back to this idea of this continuous observation in a local area. And that, you know, we, to make sweeping statements about how weather is changing all over the globe is not particularly useful. What we need is a more local approach, because it is going to become more and more unpredictable and erratic, but in different areas and affect people very, very differently. So I think that's the real strength of Indigenous knowledge, is like people being able to, and also like a sense of kind of empowerment in being able to monitor your own area, to be able to predict how things are going to change for you and not be reliant on technology necessarily, or be able to use technology yourself.
What Francis was mentioning earlier about the ceremonies, the local ceremonies being at set dates because they depend on the lunar calendar and the elders know that. But then people adapting to climate change around the ceremonies. So whereas they said when they were little, they would start sowing because it would rain on the day of the ceremony. People were like had taken into account that they would need to wait 2 or 3 days before the first rain, so they would still have the ceremony on the same day as the lunar calendar and the elders said, but then wait a couple of days before sowing, which I thought was an interesting adaptation at its simplest, which is one of the strengths that we mentioned.
I think another key factor in kind of highlighting Indigenous knowledge and its importance is to do with sustainability and actually sort of combating climate change. And this is, I suppose, there's a kind of shift or focus towards the way Indigenous communities have lived in areas consistently over thousands of years and with a kind of landscape that is nourished and survives. And I suppose this is a kind of in opposition to like capitalism's use of the landscape and a kind of monoculture type farming, industrial farming, and these kinds of things that are now proving to be completely unsustainable and sort of generating climate change itself. So there is a sort of a real necessity to look at these other ways of living in the landscape, and ultimately a kind of respect for the landscape and nature that will allow us as humans to survive on this planet.
This relationship that we saw with the land and with the calendar and these ceremonies, which are a way of kind of communing with the land or with and appreciating, respecting nature, which is woven into a very rich culture, which is still very much alive in Burkina, which, you know, I think we've lost a lot in the UK, for example.
We gathered a lot of footage from the fieldwork and interviews with rural communities. And I am in the process of producing a short film. We actually showed an early version of this film to the UK Met Office, and it was a very effective way of demonstrating the research that we had done, and also kind of conveying the place, the landscape, and the people in a more sort of immediate and direct way than academic papers tend to do. And we had a very positive response from the film.
It's interesting because a lot of papers talking about indigenous knowledge, and specifically when it's related to agriculture, have a very binary way of talking about it and evaluating its usefulness or not. And we are trying to contribute more to the area of studies that talks about weather and human and nature as a more holistic way of thinking, as opposed to just assessing if the indicators are useful or not.
It's very conceptual, really, in a way. We hope that this will be a form of advocacy towards Met Offices worldwide, but maybe, you know, more broadly than that, to people to take into account their own Indigenous knowledge, or to kind of see it as something really vital, actually, in the face of climate change.
For me, it was interesting going into a kind of a piece of research that already sort of was defined, because I suppose I usually, as an artist, go into a situation without trying to avoid any sort of predetermined idea of what I will get. So going in with a set of fixed questions that were towards that were building towards a kind of social science paper, at the same time as trying to film something open-ended and allowing the research to sort of evolve and develop according to what we discovered there. But I was quite pleased to find that we actually, the content that we got was so much more than I think we had maybe expected, and that it also developed into a kind of broader look at interactions with nature and mossy culture in relation to the horses, and the kind of opportunity to see this foal being born in front of our eyes with the warriors of the Chief of Ouagadougou. And this is something that I will never forget. It was, one of those moments in your life that you'll treasure forever. So, yeah, I suppose that it kind of grew and grew. And that's kind of one of the things that happens when you have a camera as well. I think you kind of find opportunities and ways into certain spaces that you might not otherwise have gone into. And it does kind of give you permission, and this is something that lets, I guess, more organic experiences of day-to-day life and intimate kind of personal realities happen on screen.
Wakat ninga mosama mosama wakat ninga ton tiet sara sahaninga ami fisika lenda nen ninga to yengo pip paske ton de singa mi nwa ye sikfa kaibala neba mi mbu ten kwa ngungu tigre minti tigre san tigre sarna ni tigre la mosa ye papote ring la hanki ton bank te to yingom bebe to yin kanga me ton ye le mti bumni ya sabab ti to yin kanga to yima we were pang warm. Kara, a pang warm.
Actually, one funny story is that we realised that both Camilla's photos and my shot of the birth of the foal are out of focus. And this is kind of, I was so upset because I was like, this is the most kind of rare opportunity. And then, but we'd been told that in relation to donkeys, that no one ever sees a donkey giving birth. Like, even if you're stood right next to it, you'll turn. And in that moment, the donkey will give birth. And this is something that the ancestors must be doing, and so we quite like the idea that the blurry footage is actually the ancestors doing.
And as we mentioned earlier, this whole idea of things not being captured on having a resistance to being captured on tape or on technology happened again in some of our interviews where we didn't press record and so missed some stuff. And it's just like, yeah, this nice feeling of you know, this ancestral historical thing resisting
being captured
in Western documentation.